Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right my co-host, Dan McKay.
Good morning, everybody.
And on the political left, sitting in for Shireen Gourbani, representing the Democratic Party, Emily Hayes. Hi, Emily.
Hey, thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, I love your commentary. And Emily, right off the bat, would you mind just letting people know the current status? Dan can jump in here, too. Of ballots and when they're going out. We're in the throes of election season. What do you know about the details of the ballots hitting mailboxes this week?
Yeah, so this has been something that I've definitely been thinking about the last several weeks, and I'm very excited that ballots are going out this week. I know some voters in some counties, I think up in Weber, they started getting their ballots yesterday. Salt Lake County should expect to start seeing ballots today and, you know, trickling in over the rest of the week. Voters should keep an eye out for those, fill them out, return them as soon as possible to either the mail or a drop box located around their county. It's super easy to vote. And if you're not registered yet, you can register up until October 23rd and receive a mail-in ballot, or you can register at the polls. So, yeah, we're excited to see huge turnout this year and good things for the Democratic Party.
The time is upon us. Dan, have you got a ballot in your box yet?
I was checking. I don't have it yet. I'm like a kid at Christmas waiting for the excitement of my ballot to arrive. It's a yellow envelope, so I'm just like waiting. Finally, honestly, I can't decide if people are more excited for their ballots to arrive or if they're waiting for their ballots to be counted and be over with the conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, we need to talk about that. But I want to bring up a statement that our Senator Mitt Romney put out. It was a tweet, and it was, of course, this week as we have the Amy Coney Barrett Supreme Court hearings taking place, a lot of vitriol in our country. This statement really went after it, and I'll just read a quick segment from it, Dan, and ask for your comment. He says, "I've stayed quiet with the approach of the election, but I'm troubled by our politics." And then he really calls out President Trump, saying that the president calls the Democratic vice presidential candidate a monster, repeatedly labels the Speaker of the House crazy, calls for the Justice Department to put the prior president in jail. And then he even, you know, makes it clear that the Democrats are doing some of their own things. And he brings up Pelosi's tearing up of the State of the Union address on national television and basically says it's time to lower the heat. He said that this crescendo of anger leads to a very bad place, Dan.
Well, it's interesting, you know, and I don't fault Mitt Romney for taking one position or another. I could say, honestly, the level of, you know, conversation really from everybody. I'll just point everybody to Twitter. Everybody wants to say it's the president or it's Pelosi or it's, you know, go down the list. Spend a half hour of your life on Twitter. Just run through that and you will find that I think a lot of these comments are actually reflective of what people are saying to each other. And I think that's really the bigger problem, is that people have forgotten like that they're talking to another person and they just keep like spewing things that are toxic and hateful. And honestly, it should be like this show, Natalie, where, you know, Emily and I can virtually sit in the same room and still be nice to each other, you know, even if it is virtual.
Yeah. Emily, I don't know what you make of the statement, but Senator Romney finds himself in this unique position where he's in a, you know, safe sort of political world because he has so much support from the state of Utah. He was the party's nominee for president, and he's just out there alone as this person that can say and do things that nobody else does in the Republican Party, or very few at least.
Yeah, I think that what I see with Mitt Romney is, I think he understands that what the president's been doing, his just complete subterfuge of norms in Washington, D.C. and in this country, have been harmful to the country and also to the Republican Party. I mean, like Dan said, we can have conversations, we can, you know, discuss policy and discuss issues. But when you have a leader of your party who is mocking people with disabilities, who is mocking women, who is, you know, thwarting any kind of national COVID response, like these standard things that we expect from a president, we have not seen them for the last 4 years. And I think that that gets into the country's soul. And I think that it's really resulted in a lack of discourse And, you know, if everything's just fake news, then how are you supposed to have a discussion with someone on a basis of fact? And I think the president's been setting a really bad example with that.
Yeah. You know, from the middle, I'd just say that in a national health emergency, an economic recession, really a political crisis, if you think of the fears that we have in elections and in the post-election time, I look for light, and I thought that Senator Romney shared something really important. But it does set the stage for things going on. Dan, you're an attorney. What are you thinking so far of the Supreme Court nomination hearings?
It has been phenomenal. You know,
you're loving it.
I don't know if it's just me. Maybe it's the legal background. Maybe it's, you know, I used to write for a Supreme Court summary case summary, you know, digest when I was in law school. So I've always followed the Supreme Court, and it's really, really interesting. I have been so extremely impressed with the level of preparedness of Amy Coney Barrett that it's going to be very hard. I think I think she's going to win some support from the other side, honestly, for how well she's done. That's just my pick.
Yeah. Emily, do you share that? Because she certainly is a very competent woman, holds herself well, and you know what you get with her.
Yeah. I mean, of course, I think that she's been conducting herself as well as she could. I think I would have liked to see some more answers on some of the questions that she's getting. But there's also been a lot of, you know, a lot of kind of grandstanding. It seems like the Supreme Court hearing process has become nothing but theater. And, you know, and that goes, honestly, for people on both sides of the aisle. You have Republicans who, you know, I think Mike Lee took the vast majority of his time to kind of espouse his personal views rather than questioning Amy Coney Barrett. And so I think it's not really the level of discussion that I think the American people deserve for a lifetime appointment like this.
Yeah. You know, I once heard David Brooks say that, I think it was David Brooks, say that the U.S. Senate has become a writer's colony, that they're all writing books. And when you listen to this hearing, you're right. You know, Senator Lee mostly talks. And didn't we have one senator who didn't go give any time to the nominee and just, just shared his philosophy. Yeah, Dan's nodding. Interesting. Emily, President Trump has apparently gotten through this virus just fine. How do you think that affects the national mood, the election? What's going forward?
Well, I think that it doesn't. I think it's still bad for him. We talked about this a little bit last week. And I think that people are still seeing that he is, you know, he's bucking the best practices. He's bucking the advice of public health experts. And there are these things that we've been told for, you know, months now, for most of this year, that we're supposed to be doing as good citizens to protect each other from this public health emergency. And now the president is just ignoring those. And so I think it's, people aren't going to react well. I think it's, again, bad for just people adhering to these guidelines. I know Utah, we just kind of revamped our guidelines and our approach this week, which I think is really good. But I worry about the mixed messages coming from the White House and then what people are hearing from their local leaders as far as what they need to do to keep themselves and their family safe.
Yeah. Dan, it's a national drama to me. You know, this is, truth is stranger than fiction. The fact that the president was Marine One to Walter Reed, that he came back and had the made-for-TV moment on the porch, and now apparently he's going to host rallies every single day between now and the election. Wow.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, when you think about all of, I'm not going to dissect what Emily said because it's a hot mess, but I'll say, honestly, when you look at the problems around, you know, the coronavirus and what's being solved, and the fact that, you know, the president has given a modest approach to a stimulus package, I think it's $1.2 trillion, which before the coronavirus stuff originally would have been one of the biggest stimulus packages ever. It's not enough for the Democratic Party. It was great to see, for the first time, I think, in, gosh, I don't know, probably 10 years of my life, watching Wolf Blitzer question the Speaker Nancy Pelosi about the stimulus package and why she can't just accept a $1.2 trillion effort to the American people. And watching Wolf ask her, hey, why, you know, is this really just a political issue? And watching the speaker stammer all over herself and like stumble and like she really looked bad in the fact that Wolf Blitzer actually asked her a question, that a hard question, and she didn't have an answer for it because she's used to softballs on CNN. And it was great to see Wolf take her knees out from under her, because that it's exactly right. The president has proposed a short-term stimulus of $1.2 billion, and the Democrats need to pass it and move on, but they're too stuck. And when you listen to the interview, I encourage everyone to go do it. When you listen to the interview, you see the sad state of it is my way or the highway when you're dealing with Speaker Pelosi. It's really sad.
Dan, I'm going to agree with you there. You know, we need this stimulus package. And I was looking at the numbers of what the $1.2 trillion, I wish it were $1.5. That's the number that I've been pegging off of. But it would provide stimulus checks to Americans. It would provide assistance to the UI program, unemployment insurance, some more state and local government aid, education funding, coronavirus testing and tracing, vaccine production and distribution. I mean, you just go down the list. And it's all borrowed money, and that bothers me, but it is what it is. That's where we are at.
What it doesn't do is it doesn't bail out state pension programs. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't bail out certain underfunded programs at the state level that, you know, the speaker wants to make sure gets funded. It doesn't do any of those things. So it's not this massive expansion that she's hoping for. But at the end of the day, it is needed, and it's time to get it done. And it's just ridiculous. It hasn't been.
Emily, I've agreed with Dan there, but we'll let you have the last say as we drop out. We've just got a few more seconds in this segment.
Yeah, I guess my last word on that would be, you know, the Democrats passed a additional stimulus, I believe, back in April or May, and have been waiting this whole time for negotiation to reach, you know, an agreement. And it sounds like the Republicans are finally coming to the table in a real way because they recognize that this is going to benefit people and that it's good to give stimulus, particularly ahead of an election. So I think that they'll find a way to get to a place where they can agree. But it's good to see Republicans finally agreeing that this is necessary.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm with Emily Hayes and Dan McKay. Stay tuned for our next segment.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
I'm Emily Hayes on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm glad to be with my friends, Emily and Dan. And Emily and Dan, I didn't tell you I wanted to talk about this, but I want to talk about the fly for just a minute. The fly. The Vice President Pence fly on the white hair. Who do you think sent that fly, Dan?
Well, I did see a hilarious meme that said something along the lines of, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg saying, I sent the fly or something. And I thought that was actually pretty funny, but otherwise, like, who, it's always something, you know, it just shows you the level of, I don't know where we're at, but something like that catches our attention and it turns into this national phenomena. It was really quite interesting. I thought,
I wondered if the mighty Utah student section, you know, unleashed it in there. I saw a nice, mocked up photograph that had that fly with a mask on, Emily.
Yeah, I think the fly was sent by Hillary Clinton's emails myself.
I the Gochner family has a pumpkin party every year, and we decorate our pumpkins. I don't know if any of them listen to the show, but I'm taking white paint. I'm going to paint the top of the pumpkin white and get a real fly that I affixed to the pumpkin.
That last section was because...
Should be good. Hey, we need to talk about the census for just a minute. We got the word this week that the Supreme Court is supporting the administration, if I understand it, that the Trump administration can finish up the census before the end of the month and get ready to have their numbers ready by the end of the year for apportionment, all the great things the census does. Emily, this is viewed as a partisan move, which I'm not sure that I agree with, but it basically... In a pandemic, it's hard to take a census, and so the census was asking for more time. But then they changed their mind, and then they got sued for it, and the Supreme Court says basically the executive branch is in charge here. Emily?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason this is viewed as partisan is because ending the census early is expected to result in an undercount of historically unrepresented populations. And by not counting everyone, it's going to affect us for the next decade on, you know, congressional districts, how those are apportioned to the states on funding. I mean, there's so many impacts from this. And it makes sense that, you know, of course, in a pandemic, it's going to be harder in order to complete the census. But it also means that we have to be flexible and allow enough time for it to complete. So it's been disappointing to watch this back and forth. You know, it's ending it 2 weeks early seems like it's not going to give them the amount of time to do whatever it is they feel like it's justified to end this to do. And so I'm disappointed to see this and hope that they are able to complete, you know, as much of the count as possible.
Yeah. Dan, my team would remind us that the response rate in Utah is very good. I think we're going to get a good count in Utah. Dan?
Yeah, and I'm actually hearing that from, so one of the heads of collecting the census data lives in my district, and he was telling me the other day that just the amount of, you know, their ability to contact people, because a lot of people are home, is really high. And so
interesting.
There's been a good take up rate, at least as far as Utah is concerned. And so they feel like they're in a great position as far as Utah, because that's all I can really speak to, that we've got a great count.
You know, I'm a little, I'm not as sharp on it as I used to be, but we do have ways to estimate the undercount. And I think Emily will know whether they got an undercount or not. So keep your eyes on it. Let's also, I just don't want to miss it. There's a lot of things still I want to talk about. But Emily, I love your expertise since you are head of the Salt Lake County Democratic Party. We have two competitive council races in Salt Lake County. It's Council 6, Council 12. This is Max Burdick, who is running as a write-in because he didn't get through the primary. And in Council 2, this is Mike Jensen's district, where they've got an open seat because Mike Jensen's not running. Real quick take there, Emily.
Yeah, so we've got a couple great Democratic candidates running in these seats. We've got Terry Horekesi running in 6 and Deborah Gatrell running in 2. And, you know, we're feeling really positive about the county council this year. I think these are great pickup opportunities for us, and they're running great campaigns. It was interesting in 6 to see, you know, Burdick not make it through the primary and as a write-in candidate. So it'll be interesting to see how that affects any kind of split on the Republican side. So excited. Once ballots get out today, we'll start seeing those returns, and looking forward to flipping these seats.
Yeah. Dan, I can ask you about that, but I really want to ask you about the McAdams-Owens debate. You watched it. I did not. You know, one of my kids texted me and said, "Are you watching the debate?" And I was just like, you know, I just don't have it in me tonight. I mean, I'm finding that I need to read rather than watch television, rather than be on social media. I read. So, but Dan, give us the summary of the debate.
Yeah. So the summary of the debate was Ben was asked whether he likes apple pie or ice cream. And which of those two? That was kind of the hardest questions that Ben was asked. And then Burgess was asked about, you know, QAnon. Ben was hammering him on, you know, the fact that he had a personal bankruptcy. He was hammering him on just, you know, one issue after another. And the debate moderator was kind of doing the same, and the press was kind of doing the same. And so Ben basically, for being a, you know, kind of sitting in a swing seat, he was given softballs and, in my opinion, came out looking
who moderated
very strong
Dan?
In the debate. And then Burgess,
who,
on the other
Dan,
hand,
who moderated?
Was having a hard time.
Who moderated, Dan? Sorry, I'm talking over you there.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the moderator. It's someone at the debate commission. But they had members of the press and members that were asking questions. And you had members or you had students from Salt Lake Community College that were asking questions as well, which, you know, super interesting, right? Unfortunately or fortunately, you know, our student population, they tended to ask more softball questions for Ben to hit out of the park versus, you know, harder for a Burgess.
Emily, are you thinking that the D's will hold this seat? It's, you know, obviously a focal point for the country. What happens in CD4?
Yeah, I think we're gonna hold this seat. Ben McAdams has done an incredible job representing this district. He bridges the gap between the parties. I think he really listens to his constituency. He is available to his constituents. And, You know, I think sometimes in debates, questions can look like softballs when you have a defensible position. And Ben has a defensible position. He's done a good job as our representative. And I think it's important that Burgess Owens be questioned about things like QAnon, because he has repeatedly aligned himself with this conspiracy group that is doing a lot of harm to our discourse that we were talking about earlier.
He has not aligned himself. This is a thing like... more than going on to a Roger Murdoch or some other owned network makes him a total sycophant for everything Roger Murdoch owns, right? Or no more than like taking money from one lobbyist or another, you know, makes you a total sellout for that person. As a candidate with no name ID, you answer almost every interview yes. Now, the problem with that is it seems to get you into issues with what they believe further down the road. Really, all he wants to do is have an interview about his candidacy and platform, and that's all he was doing. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he has to like be responsible for something this group then believes, like, I don't get it. You know, it's like, I don't know. If I had a dime for every time Ben McAdams went on some podcast or some interview, I want to make it very clear right now, I do not espouse everything that KCPW puts on the air because I'm doing this interview, okay? I just want you to know I have not listened to much of the other programming, but I just so you know, I don't espouse everything they broadcast. And no candidate should be accountable for everything everybody else puts on every other airway.
Emily, love to hear your quick response.
Yeah, this wasn't some, you know, public airways. This was a podcast hosted by people who believe in a conspiracy theory that Democrats are drinking the blood of children. So I would hope that people who are running to represent us in Congress would have the ability and would want to hold themselves accountable to not be aligning themselves with that for the purpose of getting, you know, support and donations, which I believe was why he went on there. And if we're not going to hold him accountable for that, then I think that that's really disingenuous.
But I'm not saying there's merit to that claim to the drinking blood of children. Like, I don't know anything about QAnon, honestly. I hadn't heard about them.
I suggest you learn, Dan, because we are about to have representatives in Congress who are running on a platform of supporting QAnon. And there has been.
Right. But see, you guys all thought it was crazy when people were making accusations about Jeffrey Epstein being this major sex criminal, right? And hanging out with influential Washington, D.C. and other influential members of both the Democratic and the Republican Party. And yet here we are. So I'm not saying QAnon's right. I'm not saying they're wrong. All I'm saying is there are things that people are involved in all over the place that none of us like. I don't like the fact that somebody believes that somebody's drinking children's blood. Let's just chuck all that aside. It's sensational and ridiculous. What really matters is let's deal with what the candidate believes and what the candidate's policies are. Where they get airtime, where they try to have interviews, where they try to get their name out there. All they're doing is trying to get votes.
Dan
and Emily, I'm going to jump in here just because we're running out of time. And we've got to talk about Governor Herbert's new transmission index and talking about dealing with what's right in front of us and their positions. He's announced changes to the COVID-19 restrictions. We've got three new levels, high, moderate, and low. The color-coded guidance is gone. What I find really interesting about this is that every Thursday, the health department will publish the new numbers, and you move automatically. There's no going through the unified command. There's no judgment that's made by the governor. And with that, you know, objective, data-driven, transmission index, you have different restrictions put on you. Dan, I'm really interested what the Utah legislature thinks about this.
Can you believe it took us this long and this much peppering behind the scenes to get to a transparent, predictable model for what should be going on? Like the high, basically for everybody else, you get a high, moderate, or low level of transmission, and how your, you know, how mandates or whatever precautions are being made at the county or state level are basically dictated as to where you fall into that transmission index. That finally is what I think a smarter way really to deal with the coronavirus, as opposed to a daily press conference with a bunch of cases and everybody running around like chickens with their heads cut off trying to figure out what the new mandate should be.
Yeah.
This is a better way to handle public
health,
like it. In my opinion.
We have less than a minute. Emily, love your quick take, but I just want to say that I want Dan to know that Utah got out the gate fast. Our data still looks good. At one time when we had a surge, we got it under 400 a day in case counts. Now we have another surge. So we've done pretty well. Emily, we just have 30 seconds left in the program.
Yeah, I'm really relieved to see this change. I think that a data-driven approach has been something that people have been calling for. And I think that this is a really positive change on the part of the state's leadership on this. So I'm excited to see this help reduce our cases that we're seeing the last couple weeks.
And finally, we're not in a state of emergency. Finally.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I've been with Emily Hayes and Dan McKay. I'm Natalie Gochner. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.